crossing the chasm. One of the key things a pragmatist customer wants to see is strong competition. If you are fresh from developing a new value proposition with visionaries, that competition is not likely to exist, at least not in a form that a pragmatist would appreciate. What you have to do then is create it. Creating the competition. In the progression of the technology adoption life cycle, the nature of competition changes dramatically. The changes are so radical that, in a very real sense, one can say at more than one point in the cycle that one has no obvious competition. Unfortunately, where there is no competition, there is no market. By way of introduction, therefore, we need to rethink the significance of competition as it relates to crossing the chasm. In our experience to date with developing an early market, competition has not come from competitive products so much as from alternative modes of operation. Resistance has been a function of inertia growing out of commitment to the status quo, fear of risk, or lack of a compelling reason to buy. Our goal in the early market has been to enlist visionary sponsors to help overcome this resistance. Their competition, in turn, has come from others within their own company, pragmatists who are vying with visionaries for dollars to fund projects. The pragmatist's competitive solution, in general, is to invest dollars to chip away at problems a piece at a time, whereas the visionaries aspire, like Alexander the Great with a Gordian knot, to cut through them with a single mighty, and mighty expensive, stroke. Pragmatists work to educate the company on the risks and costs involved. Visionaries counter with charismatic appeals to taking bold and decisive actions. The competition takes place at the level of corporate agenda, not at the level of competing products. That's how competitions work in the early market. It is not at all how they work in the mainstream, in part because there are not enough visionaries to go around, in part because visionaries themselves like to play not in the mainstream, but rather out in front of it. Now we are in the true domain of the pragmatist. In the pragmatist's domain, competition is defined by comparative evaluations of products and vendors within a common category. These comparative evaluations confer on the buying process an air of rationality that is extremely reassuring to the pragmatist. The sort of thing that manifests itself in evaluation matrices of factors weighted and scored. And the conclusions drawn from these matrices will ultimately shape the dimensions and segmentation of the mainstream market. Windows PCs, it will turn out, are best for office automation, while Macintoshes still cling to some advantages for graphics. HP 9000s are best for manufacturing, Silicon Graphics workstations for film editing, and Sun Spark stations for internet servers. Pragmatist buyers do not like to buy until there is both established competition and an established leader, for that is a signal that the market has matured sufficiently to support a reasonable whole product infrastructure around an identified centerpiece. In sum, the pragmatists are loath to buy until they can compare. Competition, therefore, becomes a fundamental condition for purchase. So coming from the early market, where there are typically no perceived competing products, with the goal of penetrating the mainstream, you often have to go out and create your competition. Creating the competition is the single most important marketing decision made in the battle to enter the mainstream. It begins with locating your product within a buying category that already has some established credibility with the pragmatist buyers. That category should be populated with other reasonable buying choices, ideally ones with which the pragmatists are already familiar. Within this universe, your goal is to position your product as the indisputably correct buying choice. The great risk here is to rig the competition. That is, to create a universe that is too self-serving. You can succeed in creating a competitive set that you clearly dominate, but this set, unfortunately, is either not credible or not attractive to the pragmatist buyers. For example, I might claim that I am the greatest high-tech marketing consultant with a PhD in Renaissance English literature. This claim might be credible, but it is not particularly attractive. On the other hand, I might claim that I am the greatest marketing consultant of all time. An attractive claim, perhaps, although it is not obvious to me how one can be a great consultant and egotistical at the same time, but, in any event, not a credible one. In high-tech marketing, the sins may not be this egregious, but they are very widespread. I am familiar with products that claim to be leaders in such categories as 100% pure Java-enabled transaction processing servers, Cobra-compliant, object-oriented messaging services, and fault-tolerant internet access gateways. These categories actually had meaning and value during the early market development for these products, because in each case, a visionary could translate the technology component into an opportunity to make a strategic breakthrough. They are meaningless, however, to pragmatist buyers. Such categories neither relate to their concerns nor emerge from the world in which they work. Moreover, these categories appear specifically designed to exclude from the competitive set the very products the pragmatist is most likely to consider as purchase alternatives. As marketing devices for crossing the chasm, therefore, they are useless. So, how can you avoid selecting a self-servicing or irrelevant competitive set? The key is to focus in on the values and concerns of the pragmatists, not the visionaries. It helps to start with the right conceptual model. In this case, the competitive positioning compass. That model is designed to create a value profile of target customers anywhere in the technology adoption lifecycle. Identify what to them would appear to be the most reasonable competitive set. Develop comparative rankings within that set on the value attributes with the highest ranking in their profile. And then build our positioning strategy development around those comparative rankings. Here's how it works. The competitive positioning compass. There are four domains of value in high-tech marketing: technology, product, market, and company. As products move through the technology adoption lifecycle, the domain of greatest value to the customer changes. In the early market, where decisions are dominated by technology enthusiasts and visionaries, the key value domains are technology and product. In the mainstream, where decisions are dominated by pragmatists and conservatives, the key domains are market and company. Crossing the chasm, in this context, represents a transition from product-based to market-based values. The competitive positioning compass, which you can see in the enhanced portion of this audiobook, illustrates these dynamics. There is a lot of information packed into this model, so let's sort it out piece by piece. The directionality provided by the compass comes in the form of the two labeled axes, A horizontal dimension shows the range of buyer interest in and understanding of high technology issues. In general, the early market is dominated by specialists who, by their nature, are more interested in technology and product issues than in market standing or company stature. By contrast, the mainstream is dominated by generalists who are more interested in market leadership and company stability than in the bits and bytes or speeds and feeds of particular products. The vertical dimension overlays a second measure: the buyer's attitude toward the proposed value proposition, ranging from skepticism to support. Markets begin in a state of skepticism and evolve to a state of support. In the case of the early market, the technology enthusiasts are the skeptical gatekeepers. In the case of the mainstream market, it is the pragmatists. Once they have given their blessings, then their companions, visionaries and conservatives, respectively, feel free to buy in. The model also points to the fact that people who are supportive of your value proposition take an interest in your products and in your company. People who are skeptical of you do not. This means that at the beginning of a market, when skepticism is the common state, basing communications on product or company strengths is a mistake. You have no permission to tout these elements, because the market players do not yet believe you are going to be around long enough to make a difference. However, there are ways to win over skeptics. Even the most skeptical specialists are always on the lookout for new technology breakthroughs. Thus, although you cannot initially get them to sponsor your product, you can get them involved in understanding its technology, and from that understanding, to gain an appreciation for the product itself. The more they appreciate the technology, the easier it becomes for them to support the product. Similarly, skeptical generalists may not take an interest in an unproven company, but are always interested in new market developments. If you can show the generalists that there is an emerging unmet market requirement, one that you have specifically positioned your products and your marketing efforts to meet, then out of their appreciation for the market opportunity, they can learn to appreciate your company. These are the two natural marketing rhythms in high tech: developing the early market and developing the mainstream market. You develop an early market by demonstrating a strong technology advantage and converting it to product credibility. And you develop a mainstream market by demonstrating a market leadership advantage and converting it to company credibility. By contrast, the chasm transition represents an unnatural rhythm. Crossing the chasm requires moving from an environment of support among the visionaries back into one of skepticism among the pragmatists. It means moving from the familiar ground of product-oriented issues to the unfamiliar ground of market-oriented ones, and from the familiar audience of like-minded specialists to the unfamiliar audience of essentially uninterested generalists. Now let's tie all this back into creating the competition. If we are going to succeed in winning over the lower right quadrant, the skeptical pragmatists, then that competition has to be based in market-oriented concerns. That's what the pragmatists care about. In other words, we must shift our marketing focus from celebrating product-centric value attributes to market-centric ones. Here is a representative list of each. On the left, product-centric. Fastest product, easiest to use, elegant architecture, product price, unique functionality. On the right, market-centric. largest installed base, most third-party supporters, de facto standard, cost of ownership, quality of support. In the previous chapter, the entire basis of the focus on whole product and partners and allies was to move our leadership premise from the left-hand list to the right. That is, lacking an existing market leadership position, we wanted, within the confines of a manageable market segment, to create the valued attributes of one, and thereby bring a state of true market leadership into existence. Now we need to communicate what we have accomplished so as to win the pragmatist buyer's support. To sum up, it is the market-centric value system, supplemented but not superseded by the product-centric one, that must be the basis for the value profile of the target customers when crossing the chasm. This value profile, in turn, will model how the target customers are likely to perceive the competitive set and what position they are likely to accord to a new player coming into that set. Let's see how this works out in a real-world example. Creating the competition. The example of Silicon Graphics. Creating the competition involves using two competitors as beacons so that the market can locate your company's unique value proposition. The first of these two competitors we will call the market alternative. This is a company that the target customer has been buying from for years. The problem they address is the one we will address, and the budget that is allocated to them represents the money we, as the new entrant, are going to preempt. To earn the right to this budget, we are going to use a discontinuous product innovation to address a problematic limitation in the traditional offer. The second reference competitor we will call the product alternative. This is a company that has also harnessed a discontinuous innovation, perhaps, but not necessarily, the same one we have, and is positioning itself, like us, as a technology leader. Their very existence gives credibility to the notion that now is the time to embrace a discontinuity. Our intent here is to acknowledge their technology, but to differentiate from them by virtue of our own niche market focus. Here's how it played out in the case of Silicon Graphics. The market they targeted was Hollywood, specifically the post-production film editing process. Traditional editing was done by cutting and splicing film, literally, hence the phrase, the cutting room floor. But beyond a certain messiness, this method has a major limitation. Namely, if the image you want didn't get on the film, there's not a lot you can do about it now, short of a hugely expensive reshoot. Silicon Graphics was able to bring to this market a radically discontinuous innovation. If the image you want is not on the film, put it there. This is the magic of digital editing. It's trump card over traditional analog methods. There is simply no way the traditional vendors could match it. As a result, they made perfect market alternatives. Referencing them made clear who was Silicon Graphics' target customer and what was the compelling reason to buy. It made clear what the whole product would have to be, what trade shows the company would have to go to, and what kind of people they would have to seek out as partners and allies. At the same time, asking artists to embrace computers and asking their producers to pay for them creates a kind of credibility crisis. Just who is this Silicon Graphics, and what exactly is a digital workstation? In order to shore up its credibility, the company needed a referenceable product alternative. Here, both Sun and Hewlett-Packard fit in nicely. Both had Unix workstations that were leading edge and thus worthy product alternatives to Silicon Graphics. Both were famous companies. Both validated Silicon Graphics. At the same time, neither company had undertaken the exceptional commitments needed by the film industry. This could be demonstrated easily to a prospective customer simply by turning all three workstations around and looking at the ports coming out the back. Both Sun and HP had the standard ports for connecting to computer peripherals and networks. But the Silicon Graphics workstation, in addition to all these, had half a dozen other ports that hooked it to devices specific to the film editing industry. It was obvious that they had made a niche commitment. The others had not. To sum up, your market alternative helps people identify your target customer, what you have in common, and your compelling reason to buy, where you differentiate. Similarly, your product alternative helps people appreciate your technology leverage, what you have in common, and your niche commitment, where you differentiate. Thus, you create the two beacons that triangulate to teach the market your positioning. A second example, Quicken. In the case of Silicon Graphics, there was a pre-existing market of film editors who were saddled with a broken, mission-critical business process. This is the ideal market condition for a beachhead landing. But not everyone gets dealt so nice a hand. Consider the plight of any innovative consumer product, for example. It is usually able to capture the attention of the technology enthusiasts. But once that class of customers is exhausted, or rather falls prey to attention deficit disorder, and wanders off to look at the next cool tool, what is the vendor to do? There are no visionaries in consumer markets to underwrite major ongoing R&D, nor are there typically mission-critical processes to fix. Now what? Let's look at how a company called Intuit tackled this problem with a product called Quicken. Quicken, from a PC specialist's point of view, belongs to a category of software called financial management applications for home use. Today, it is the market leader. There was a time, however, when the success of the product and the company hung by a thread. How Intuit and its president Scott Cook responded to that situation provides a superb lesson in how creating the right competition can accelerate crossing the chasm. When Quicken was first introduced into the market, the best-selling program was Andrew Tobias's Managing Your Money. From a product-centric point of view, it was far richer in functionality than Quicken, offering portfolio analysis and other financial modeling capabilities. To the financial enthusiasts who made up the early market for these products, it was clearly the preferred choice, and Intuit was doomed if it continued to play the game on that turf. In casting about for alternatives, Intuit hit on very simple value proposition for the home computer user. Make it easier to pay bills. This is a pragmatist type of value proposition. We are not making a strategic breakthrough, but rather an incremental improvement in a recurrent operation. It is, in other words, a marketing opportunity for the mainstream, not the early market. Unfortunately for Intuit, there was no established mainstream category called computer-aided bill paying. Pragmatists use checkbooks, thank you very much, and they work just fine. So how could Intuit penetrate this market? First, they had to find a manageable market segment. In this case, the world was already pretty well restricted by the qualifier, adults who use computers in their home. The key issue then became checks. If Quicken were to be easier than a manual system, it had to be easy to get the checks. Intuit decided to handle that process for their end user. As a result, today, income from providing checks is a key component of the company's business strategy, the margins being excellent and the cost of sales virtually nil. Then a third issue arose. How to align the checks with the printer correctly so that everything printed in the right spot. This turned out to be a major technical problem, ultimately requiring Intuit to invent a subsequently patented solution. Once that was accomplished, however, a true whole product was in place. Now we come to creating the competition. Can you see how it falls out? The market alternative is paper and pen checking. That is the familiar alternative. What we are going to offer is more speed and convenience during bill paying, plus the opportunity to control one's finances by seeing where the money goes, plus a much more organized set of resources with which to tackle tax time. Please note that these are not really broken processes, so much as sort of bent processes. Hence, the slipperiness of the slope that Quicken had to climb to get out of the chasm. But they were compelling, particularly to PC owners looking for more ways to leverage the technology at home. Thus, if you were a home PC user and a bill payer, you knew that Intuit wanted you. The product alternative was managing your money. Rather than fight it in a features war, Intuit could now use it as a reference beacon. That product, they could say, is the one for financial enthusiasts who want to analyze their investment portfolios. This product is for ordinary householders paying their monthly bills. How can you tell? Well, look at how simple we have made it to use. Look at our checkbook interface metaphor. Look at the way we handle the checks themselves. To close on this example, this is what we mean by defining the battle. You choose your competition to help you define the niche market you will dominate. As long as they are well-behaved and stay out of your niche, you go out of your way to honor their achievements elsewhere. If they should stray into your niche, on the other hand, you must defeat them totally. The beachhead segment must be your niche and yours alone, separated from all others by tall barriers to entry. Just remember your Robert Frost. Good fences make good neighbors. Creating the competition. Some current opportunities. So much for looking backward. Hindsight is always 20/20. Let's see what happens when we try to create some competition for products that are just now crossing the chasm. Three worth looking at are ChannelPoint, Diffusion, and VerticalNet. All three at the time of this writing are pre-chasm with early adopter customers, and all are contemplating their chasm-crossing strategies. None of them is anything like a household name. This presents a major positioning challenge. Now, we know that the one place an unknown company is welcome to position itself is in an empty space, fulfilling an unmet need. The problem is that no one wants to listen very long to hear about it. Here is where using two familiar reference beacons as the market alternative and the product alternative comes in so handy. Channel point. Re-engineering the insurance distribution chain. Channel Point of Colorado Springs represents the intersection of a group of internet-savvy engineers that spun out of Sun with a visionary management team that saw in the traditional insurance distribution system a process crying out to be re-engineered. Today, in health insurance, for example, there is a chain that begins on the supply end with 1. Underwriting insurers, who develop products which are then communicated to 2. General agents who aggregate offerings from many insurers and present them to 3. Independent agents who present an appropriate subset to 4. Potential clients who, with the independent agent's help, select the best offering, which leads back to 3. The independent agent writing up an application, each company's being a little different, and seeking clarifications from 2. The general agent who either knows or has to go back to 1. The underwriting insurer to get the answer. As we often like to say about early software products, this system may be hard to use, but at least it's slow. ChannelPoint intends to use the internet to re-engineer this process. It will initially team with or acquire general agents who have aggregated content and convert that content to internet format. It will simultaneously migrate a portion of the support desk from telephone to the internet as well, with email as the initial communication channel, moving to chat and IP telephony as needed. At the same time, it will work with the independent agents in the relationship to get them internet ready at their end. It only requires a browser and a willing attitude. Later on in the process, the company will help extend the internet back into the insurer's domain to facilitate their application processing workflow. But just bridging the general and the independent agent domains can take a huge chunk out of the cost and delay in the system. Later still, one can envision the end customer also getting involved, initially to inquire about claims or premiums, eventually to submit either or both. All in all, it is a very interesting business idea. So how to position it? The market alternative is clearly the traditional general agent. By mentioning this category and calling out 2 or 3 of the better-known firms, ChannelPoint can immediately capture the attention of their target market and simultaneously let the rest of us tune out. This last consequence is not only good for us, but good for ChannelPoint, as they do not want to clog up their sales and marketing communications channels with irrelevant inquiries. Okay, now that we have called out the industry's most stalwart firms, how in the world can a no-name startup hope to compete credibly? Here is where we invoke our product alternative. This should be a well-known example of a technology-based offer that re-engineered the way a mature industry brokered its value chain relationships. One of the most visible of these is the Sabre system, which re-engineered the way that the airlines distribute tickets. ChannelPoint positions itself, in other words, at the intersection of 1. The general agent for property and casualty insurance with 2. The Sabre system for brokering community interactions. It uses its Sabre-like technology to differentiate from the traditional general agent, and it uses its niche insurance industry focus to differentiate from a Sabre-like internet competitor such as Yahoo. In a bar, when asked what ChannelPoint does, I can now say, "Oh, they're the Sabre system for the insurance industry." Now, it is not that I am encouraging you to hang out in bars, or even to suggest that I do very often myself, although I am peculiarly susceptible to a fine Cabernet. Rather, the point is that the level of attention one anticipates in a bar is about on par with what a no-name startup can expect, on first acquaintance, from a potential customer, partner, or investor. And so it is crucial that it be able to cut through the noise with a curt phrase that can register even upon the most unattentive neurons. Diffusion. Communications for customer retention. At the time of this writing, Diffusion is a startup in Silicon Valley focused on leveraging the explosion in electronic communications channels. Internet, fax, email, office phone, pager, cell phone, PDA. To help companies such as banks and brokerages provide increasingly more customer-delighting interactions with their most valued clientele. Their essential offer has three dimensions. One, to their customers' clients, it is a promise to communicate with them via whatever channel they themselves prefer. Thus, I might ask to be emailed most information, but to be paged with urgent items. Whereas Marie might prefer print catalogs or a phone call, and Michael might want to get a fax. Two, to the customers themselves, the offer is to improve customer management by cross-connecting all the various touchpoints in their customer contact system. Thus, today, my bank might have several programs contacting me: direct mail, a personal web page, a phone call from an account manager, all operating as independent silos. Diffusion's technology integrates all these mechanisms into a single system for customer relationship management. Three, in addition to the proliferation of outbound media reflected above, there is a parallel internal proliferation of content sources, be they customer information systems for taking and confirming orders or providing customer service or support, marketing systems such as catalogs or direct mail, or publishing systems both from internal websites and via dynamic extraction from front office databases. Thus, a marketing group seeking to provide a differentiated relationship with valued clients has a daunting set of tasks facing it if the system is to scale to any size. Again, enter Diffusion with a technology to map all the goes-intas to all the goes-outas. Now, one of the challenges that a startup like Diffusion faces is that customers have no budget set aside for purchasing the new offer because they didn't even know the category existed, much less the company or the product. Here again, choosing the right market alternative is key. Basically, you are choosing the budget upon which you intend to poach. In the case of Diffusion, one path would be to target Gold Club account management budgets as the market alternative. These budgets are under the control of Diffusion's target customer, and they address the key benefit, clientele retention, that Diffusion seeks to enhance. The problem today is that Gold Club programs are too expensive to use for any but the bank or brokerage's most valued clients. But by focusing here, Diffusion can give prospective customers the mental positioning experience of, oh, so you are a way I can extend my customer relationship management programs more cost-effectively? That gives them a place to park the company in terms of budget and authority to make the buying decision. Now comes time for the product alternative. Here, Diffusion faces a special challenge. There is no direct product alternative that matches up well to what they do. There is a project alternative, that is, an early market offer, to accomplish the same goals, building out a custom system with a technology vendor like Broadvision or an enterprise systems partner like IBM. The problem with choosing an early market offer as the competition is that pragmatist customers want to see something comparable already across the chasm before they buy in. So what is Diffusion to do? One path is to choose an analogous product as the product alternative. This is not a buying choice, but it does provide a point of reference for appreciating the usefulness and practicality of the new offer. In the case of Diffusion, one possible analogous offer is the customer profile systems that airlines and travel agencies provide. While they do not specify information flow, they do build a customer profile for repeat clients that captures their travel preferences to ensure better service automatically. By analogy, Diffusion's position might be, "Oh, so you're a customer profile system for managing our account relationships with Gold Club clients." Now, this is not a perfect fit by any means, but it is within range. High-value customer management is the market, and customer profiling is a key product attribute, albeit not the only one. At minimum, it is better than starting with, "We're an internet-enabled multimedia outbound communications facility for one-to-one marketing programs based on client-provided communication channel preferences," or some other such mind-numbing concatenation of abstractions that, when said to your mother, makes her eyes cloud over with worry for her misdirected offspring. Vertical net. Internet sites for micro-segments. Vertical net, at the time of this writing, I keep using this phrase because, with the arrival of internet time, God knows what will be operative in the world by the time you are reading this paragraph, is a startup focused on creating destination sites for highly specialized vertical markets, most of which have an engineering spin to them. The good news is, the competition is not stiff. Where else in the world, for example, could you find an entire website called www.solidwaste.com? But if you are an environmental engineer looking for specialized industry information, this thing is a gold mine. Click on the buyer's guide, and a veritable cornucopia of offers unfolds. Say you are attracted to sludge collection. Click there, and wait. There's more. 15 or so subtopics emerge. Hard a flutter, you click on removal, wastewater sludge. And then, mirabile dictu, not one, not two, but 20 different companies are listed, all of which offer this service, one in the area near you. But say it was a slow day. Then instead of searching in Yellow Pages fashion, you could content yourself with browsing the industry news, entering a chat group on your favorite solid waste topic, or sitting on a live interview with a solid waste guru, possibly an oxymoron. Could Dilbert ever be made happier? Honestly, this is what the internet was made for. Vertical net just has to get the word out. The question is, to whom? Who is the customer? It turns out, if you are a media play, then your customer is either an advertiser or a vendor selling on your site. It is not Dilbert with whom you need to position, but rather the people who want to sell to him. And since the world of solid waste is not under any market pressure to re-engineer itself, you can expect that it is filled with conservatives, not visionaries, and that the Internet Advertising Expenditures or Internet Reseller Commission programs are not in their current budget. Now what? Choosing the competition is key here, and Vertical Net has moved wisely. As its market alternative, it identifies the leading trade magazine that services whatever target market it is going after. Indeed, in some cases it has gone so far as to recruit the editor of that magazine to join its team. The site then becomes an interactive forum based on the same news, same issues, and the same advertisers as the trade magazine. It is a true zine. This makes it very easy for conservative buyers to identify the dollars they would use to experiment with this new medium. As its product alternative, VerticalNet points to internet community sites like America Online. Even conservatives have heard of this company, and its success in creating virtual communities communicates exactly the phenomenon that VerticalNet wants to highlight in its own positioning. Oh. You're sort of an AOL for specialized vertical niches. Yes. In closing, let me just close this section with a heads-up alert. If you try out this exercise of choosing the competition and have trouble finding a single clear market alternative, this is a clue. It means that you are not ready to cross the chasm. Chasm crossing requires a single target beachhead segment. And in that segment, there needs to exist already the budget dollars to buy your offer. To be sure, the budget will be misnamed because it will be allocated to some brain-dead, ineffective band-aid approach to solving what has become a broken, mission-critical process. But it must exist, or else you will lose a full year just in educating the market to put aside money that might be used to buy your product in the following year. Choosing your market alternative wisely is the solution to this problem, but it has to be credible. And understand that as soon as you call out your choice, you are in for a fight. That market alternative, whoever it may be, had plans for that money. Indeed, it considers that budget as its budget, and it will not take kindly to your actions. That's where the product alternative comes in. You need to make clear to everyone involved that a technology shift is underway here, and that old solutions simply cannot hope to keep up. Trade magazines on their best day cannot be interactive. Direct mail programs on their best day cannot catch me at the golf course. General agents on their best day cannot provide round-the-clock answers to independent agents' questions, at least not cost-effectively. It is not your intent to deride the performance of the established old guard. Indeed, you should honor it, as your target customer has long-standing relationships with these vendors. Rather, it is to suggest that a new wave is coming, and that you intend to domesticate that technology to the same ends as these tried-and-true solution providers. So, market alternatives call out the budget, and thus the market category. And product alternatives call out the differentiation. It sounds a lot like positioning, the topic to which we will now turn. Positioning. Creating the competition, more than anything else, represents a watershed moment in positioning. Positioning is the most discussed and least well-understood component of high-tech marketing. You can keep yourself from making most positioning gaffes if you will simply remember the following principles. 1. Positioning, first and foremost, is a noun, not a verb. That is, it is best understood as an attribute associated with a company or a product, and not as the marketing contortions that people go through to set up that association. 2. Positioning is the single largest influence on the buying decision. It serves as a kind of buyer's shorthand, shaping not only their final choice, but even the way they evaluate alternatives leading up to that choice. In other words, evaluations are often simply rationalizations of pre-established positioning. 3. Positioning exists in people's heads, not in your words. If you want to talk intelligently about positioning, you must frame a position in words that are likely to actually exist in other people's heads, and not in words that come straight out of hot advertising copy. 4. People are highly conservative about entertaining changes in positioning. This is just another way of saying that people do not like you messing with the stuff that is inside their heads. In general, the most effective positioning strategies are the ones that demand the least amount of change. Given all of the above, it is then possible to talk about positioning as a verb. A set of activities designed to bring about positioning as a noun. Here, there is one fundamental key to success. When most people think of positioning in this way, they are thinking about how to make their products easier to sell. But the correct goal is to make them easier to buy. Companies focus on making products easier to sell because that is what they are worried about, selling. They load their marketing communications with every possible selling argument, following the age-old axiom that if you throw a lot of mud at a wall, some of it is bound to stick. Prospective customers shrink from this barrage, which in turn causes the salespeople to chase after them that much harder. Even though the words appear to address the customer's values and needs, the communication is really focused on the seller's attempt to manipulate them, a fact that is transparently obvious to the potential consumer. It's a complete turnoff, all because the company was trying to make its product easy to sell instead of easy to buy. Think about it. Most people resist selling, but enjoy buying. By focusing on making a product easy to buy, you are focusing on what the customers really want. In turn, they will sense this and reward you with their purchases. Thus, easy to buy becomes easy to sell. The goal of positioning, therefore, is to create a space inside the target customer's head called best buy for this type of situation, and to attain sole, undisputed occupancy of that space. Only then, when the green light is on and there is no remaining competitive alternative, is a product easy to buy. Now, the nature of that best buy space is a function of who is the target customer. Indeed, this space builds and expands cumulatively as the product passes through the technology adoption lifecycle. There are four fundamental stages in this process, corresponding to the four primary psychographic types, as follows. 1. Name it and frame it. Potential customers cannot buy what they cannot name, nor can they seek out the product unless they know what category to look under. This is the minimum amount of positioning needed to make the product easy to buy for a technology enthusiast. Discontinuous innovations are often difficult to name and frame. The largely ineffectual category, middleware, is an attempt to name and frame a new class of system software that lives between established platforms of enabling technology, the operating system, the database, and the network operating system, and established applications, say, financials, human resources, or Salesforce automation. It turns out that businesses are wanting to make all these applications interoperate, and to do that requires messaging software, transaction processing software, object brokering software, and the like. It is all very complicated technically, and gives rise to sectarian fanaticism, which nobody wants to deal with. So as an industry, we have collectively agreed to throw it all in a bucket called middleware and hope we can just keep a lid on it. The problem with all this is that we cannot keep it in the bucket. The need for it keeps calling it out. But once it gets out, because we cannot name it and frame it properly, all companies who provide it are stuck with a nasty marketing problem. Customers go into prolonged review cycles, religious wars break out, and sales get postponed as each situation battles over the same tired ground. Recently, there has been something of a breakthrough in this space with the rise of a category called Enterprise Application Integration, or EAI. This phrase displaces middleware, a word which does nothing more than reference a location in a software system's hierarchy, with a phrase that communicates a critical benefit. It also frames the space by confining it to applications integration, and even more specifically, by the word enterprise, to high-end server applications. There is a clear market alternative here. All the money companies pay systems integrators to do this work. And so the market should now be able to move on. 2. Who for and what for? Customers will not buy something until they know who is going to use it and for what purpose. This is the minimum extension to positioning needed to make the product easy to buy for the visionary. This is the challenge for the electronic book. It has been named and framed quite well, but it is not clear who is going to buy it or for what reason. It is the same sort of challenge that smart cards face in the United States. As it becomes clear who can most benefit from these technologies to achieve a major strategic advantage, then they will have secured the necessary positions to develop their respective early markets. 3. Competition and differentiation. Customers cannot know what to expect or what to pay for a product until they can place it in some sort of comparative context. This is the minimum extension to positioning needed to make a product easy to buy for a pragmatist. Examples of this category have filled the preceding pages of this chapter. The key is to provide the reassurance of a competitive set and of a market-leading choice within that set. 4. Financials and futures. Customers cannot be completely secure in buying a product until they know it comes from a vendor with staying power who will continue to invest in this product category. This is the final extension of positioning needed to make a product easy to buy for a conservative. Microsoft, IBM, Oracle, and Intel are all long-standing blue-chip companies with whom conservatives feel comfortable. Emerging blue chips like SAP and Cisco also create this comfort factor. And so can smaller companies, if they can dominate a niche market, the way Documentum has done in pharmaceuticals and Lawson Software in healthcare. The purpose of positioning is to put in place these sets of perceptions with the appropriate target customers in the appropriate sequence and at the appropriate time in the development of a product's market. The positioning process. When positioning is thought of primarily as a verb, it refers to a communications process made up of four key components. 1. The claim. The key here is to reduce the fundamental position statement, a claim of undisputable market leadership within a given target market segment, to a two-sentence format outlined later in this chapter. 2. The evidence. The claim to undisputed leadership is meaningless if it can in fact be disputed. The key here is to develop sufficient evidence as to make any such disputation unreasonable. 3. Communications. Armed with claim and evidence, the goal here is to identify and address the right audiences in the right sequence with the right versions of the message. 4. Feedback and adjustment. Just as football coaches have to make halftime adjustments to their game plans, so do marketers once the positioning has been exposed to the competition. Competitors can be expected to poke holes in the initial effort, and these need to be patched up or otherwise responded to. This last component makes positioning a dynamic process rather than a one-time event. As such, it means marketers revisit the same audiences many times over during the life of a product. Establishing relationships of trust, therefore, rather than wowing them on a one-time basis, is key to any ongoing success. The claim. passing the elevator test. Of the four components, by far the hardest to get right is the claim. It is not that we lack for ideas.